Good morning. Some Democrats say they needed to vote to reopen the government. Others responded like in that painting, The Scream. What are the political effects? We talk with Seth Moulton of Massachusetts on Morning Edition from NPR News. Rising costs changing the political views of Americans in their 20s and 30s. I'm Leila Faldick.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We heard from over 1,000 young voters, some of whom don't feel served by either party. Also, the FDA is removing warning labels for hormone therapy used to treat menopause. What does the science say? It's Tuesday, November 11th. This Veterans Day, NPR's Quil Lawrence has been talking with an Iraq War veteran for 10 years. What does this country owe those who served? The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Last night, the Senate voted on a measure that would bring the government shutdown to an end.
On this vote, the ayes are 60, the nays are 40. The bill, as amended, is passed.
The measure now heads for the House. NPR's Sam Gringlas explains what's inside this government spending measure.
The Senate passed a stopgap funding bill lasting through January 30th after a more than month-long impasse that resulted in missed paychecks for federal workers, delayed food assistance, and air travel disruptions. The package includes a trio of regular appropriations bills funding some parts of the government through next September, as well as language to reverse the shutdown firings of federal employees and ensure that federal workers get back pay. But the deal does not include an extension of expiring subsidies for health insurance premiums. Democrats have been promised a Senate vote on legislation to address the health care subsidies, but that does not guarantee it'll pass or get a vote in the House. Sam Gringlas, NPR News, Washington.
The government shutdown has interrupted federal food assistance for more than 40 million Americans. A federal judge has ordered President Trump to spend contingency money so people can access money for the food. Trump is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to block that order and opposes sending the contingency money for food. People getting the aid are facing confusion. From member station KOSU, Anna Pope visited a food pantry in Oklahoma.
Amparo Espinosa has been going to the Middell Food Pantry in Midwest City for about 6 years. Espinosa likes coming here. The people are nice. But a month ago, she says there wasn't a wait.
You could see the need to get food because of what happened with the government. And I think it's very sad that we are suffering the consequences of the people that should take care of us.
Last month, many here were getting food aid through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, including Espinosa. This month, Espinosa has not yet received her $21 through SNAP. She says the program helps her afford certain things. But for others, she knows it is a lifeline. For NPR News, I'm Anna Pope in Midwest City, Oklahoma.
President Trump is again suggesting that money collected by the U.S. from tariffs on imported goods could be given to some Americans.
And one of the things we're going to do, we're going to issue a dividend to our middle income people and lower income people of about $2,000. And we're going to use the remaining tariffs to lower our debt.
But Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said over the weekend that the dividend could take several other forms rather than direct payments. Bessent suggested that could come from no taxes imposed on income from tips, overtime, or other areas. The U.S. Supreme Court is deciding how much power the president has to impose tariffs. President Trump has been writing online criticizing opposition to his actions on tariffs. This is NPR. A frigid mass of cold air continues to blanket the eastern two-thirds of the country. A winter storm is pulling away from the Great Lakes region. Officials in the Chicago area delayed flights because of the storm. That's on top of reduced air traffic in the U.S. due to the government shutdown. A federal appeals court panel has ruled in favor of striking news employees at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The ruling upholds a decision that the newspaper's owners engaged in bad faith bargaining during contract negotiations. The workers have been on strike for 3 years. Kyle Ferreira reports.
The ruling comes amid the longest ongoing strike in the country. Last year, the National Labor Relations Board found that the Post-Gazette's owner, the Block Company, had bargained in bad faith and ordered it to undo cuts to health care benefits and other changes to employment terms. The appeals panel agreed and upheld the board's order, but the case is far from over. Ernst Orsatti is a labor lawyer with Quattrini Law Group, which is not involved in the case.
If they weren't stringing out, that's exactly what could happen. I've had NLRB cases that lasted 5 to 6 years because employers were determined to drag them out.
The Post-Gazette's owner can still appeal. That process alone could take another year. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Ferreira in Pittsburgh.
This is Veterans Day. It's also the anniversary of the end to fighting in World War I with the signing of an armistice between the Allies and Germany. It was supposed to take effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
August 1990, 3M, short for Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, was a quintessentially Minnesota company famous for Scotchgard, Post-it notes, and other everyday and more obscure products.
What's so special about a carpet with Scotchgard?
So why was it suddenly embroiled in a controversy involving a North Carolina senator and a billboard in West Hollywood, California? The senator was Jesse Helms, known as Senator No for his opposition to things like HIV/AIDS funding and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Robbie Cannell,
now a California artist, had rented a billboard and plastered it with an image of Helms' face superimposed on an artist's palette, the whole going through Helms' head, over the slogan, Artificial, Art Official. That's when phones started ringing at 3M in St. Paul, because 3M owned the billboard in West Hollywood through a subsidiary. The company immediately reacted by pulling down the billboard, but after another uproar, it put it back up. Free speech holding more weight than pleasing Senator Helms.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
On this Veterans Day, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Here's where the longest federal government shutdown stands. The Senate voted last night to end it. The House has yet to vote.
Republicans got roughly what they demanded, reopening the government without extending subsidies for health insurance. Just enough Senate Democrats agreed to do without extending those subsidies, although the Senate at least will vote on them soon. So what does that mean for the party that was trying to find some way to assert itself?
Coming up, we'll hear from Representative Seth Moulton of Massachusetts. We begin with the big picture.
NPR's senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro has been following that. Domenico, good morning.
Hey, great to be with you.
What's a way to think about this result?
Well, you know, Democrats are certainly right now getting a lot of backlash from the left. And, you know, for some understandable reasons, I mean, they feel like they continue to get rolled, that the party promises one thing and then in the end caves or doesn't quite keep up the fight. So you understand a lot of the irritability from the left about this toward Democrats. But it might not be as bad for Democrats in the long run here into the 2026 midterm elections. I mean, they have the opportunity, Democrats, to look like the adults in the room who care, you know, if people go hungry. And they also raise the issue of health care subsidies, which many weren't talking about before this shutdown fight. And yeah, if they get this promised vote in December on health care subsidies, then it's certainly going to draw a dividing line, and Republicans are really going to own that issue. And there were divides between, you know, people in the party before these off-year elections. Democrats still swept across the country. And the reason why was because of that issue of affordability. That's still likely to be the top issue next year, too.
Oh, this is interesting. So if Democrats did well in last week's elections and at least raised their issue, even if they didn't win the issue in this shutdown fight, is there any particular danger for the Democrats who voted to reopen the government?
You know, I think we're going to see potentially more primaries in the next year. I think the left has certainly gotten more activist and more engaged in this fight. But remember, most Democratic members of Congress were against this move. Yeah. You know, I think they're going to try to sell that to their constituents. I think what we're seeing is also indicative of a changing Democratic Party, one that's moved from really a pragmatism to a pugilism in the age of Trump, really wanting fighters. It was a party that was far more willing to compromise than it is now. Polling showing that. There was an NBC poll, for example, in 2016. 2017 have found that 6 in 10 Democrats are more likely favoring compromising with Trump. During his second term here, that's flipped. 2/3 of Democrats earlier this year in that same poll said they thought members of the party should stand on principle. Instead, that was back in March, right around the time when there was almost a shutdown before Democratic leader Chuck Schumer pulled the plug and worked with Republicans to keep it open.
Is Senator Schumer in any trouble?
I think he's in a really tough position, frankly. I mean, he held the line for 40 days saying don't reopen the government unless Republicans negotiate on these health care subsidies, but senators defied his public comments. So either he was unable to keep everyone on the same page, or he tacitly allowed folks to vote this way. And there's some question about that because none of the people who came out in favor of this deal are up for re-election next year. Two of them are retiring. It was really a group that could weather the political blowback on this. And look, he's 74. He's not where the party is heading right now. It would not be surprising, as I've heard other Democrats and Democratic strategists say, to see him not leading the party in 2027, regardless of the outcome of next year's midterms.
Who has the advantage heading into those midterms?
You know, I still think it's hard not to see it being Democrats. You know, affordability was the main issue of the past election. It's very likely to be again next year. And if that's the case, and the cost of living is still pinching people's pockets, then with Trump and Republicans in charge, it's still going to be an edge for Democrats. Plus, Democrats have the issues on their side. In addition to affordability, there's health care. And as we know, congressional elections and control of the House are determined in these swing districts. And winning is going to cure a lot of ills if the environment stays the way it does.
Also, people keep voting against whoever is in. So Democrats have the advantage there. Domenico, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Domenico Montanaro. Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton is among the House Democrats who are criticizing the Senate deal, and he's on the line. Congressman, good morning.
Good morning.
Here's an argument, listening to Domenico, that you could make in favor of reopening the government now. You made your point. You raised your issue. You don't have the power to prevail on the issue right now, but you made it clear who's blocking you, and now you move on. What's wrong with that thinking?
Why would you give up now? I mean, this is actually when the Republicans seem to be starting to give in. You have Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of the most extreme Republicans in history, saying that she can't afford health care for her own family. And so the Democrats are right, and Republicans should give in. Just after the Democratic sweep in last Tuesday's elections, you had Trump come out and say, the shutdown is a real problem. You need to come bring this to an end. So why you would give up now and put Americans in a position where they're not going to be able to afford health care in a few months, I just don't know. We're the only folks standing between Donald Trump and the American people.
There was, of course, an opposite position expressed by John Fetterman of Pennsylvania. He's one of the Democrats who voted to reopen the government. He spoke with our colleague Scott Detrow on All Things Considered yesterday. Let's listen to that.
I absolutely support extending those tax credits. But for me, the kinds of chaos and holding our government hostage is unacceptable. And you can have priorities, but it's wrong to go shutting our government down.
Do you think that another week or another month would have made a difference?
I think it would have. I think the administration was feeling the pressure, especially going into the Thanksgiving holiday. They didn't want chaos over Thanksgiving. They didn't want people unable to get home for Thanksgiving. This was just the wrong time to give in. You don't capitulate at the moment where you think that the other side is actually coming around. With all due respect to Senator Fetterman, I mean, he sounds like he's using Trump's talking points here. And that's what we don't need. We don't need people who are giving in to Donald Trump. We need people who are fighting him on behalf of the American people.
Well, that raises another interesting question, because as some people will know, Congressman, you're running for U.S. Senate from Massachusetts. You're in the Democratic primary. If you were to win, would you be voting for the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer to remain the Democratic leader?
No, I will not. I think there's a leadership vacuum in the Democratic Party right now, and it's time for a new generation of Democrats to step up. And that's the message I'm running on in Massachusetts, and it's the message that we need to hear across the country. The two brightest spots for Democrats in the past week were Abigail Spanberger in Virginia and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, representing a new generation of leadership and now taking over entire states. That's what Democrats are excited about right now. We're frustrated, frankly, with the status quo, with the same old playbook that Schumer and others are using that's led us to a second term of Donald Trump, where he's hurting a lot of people.
I'm intrigued by your analysis of last week's elections, because you mentioned the Democrats who won the governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey, who are considered a bit more pragmatic. You did not mention Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic socialist on the Democratic ticket, who won the mayoralty of New York. Where does he fit into your analysis of the direction of the party?
He's also young. he also represents a new generation of leaders. I mean, that's the point. The people who are winning right now are a new generation who is stepping up to make a difference for this country. And that's what we need right now. The status quo has not worked. And people right now who are just protecting the establishment, they're not getting it done for the Democratic Party.
Are you getting close, and I don't mean in terms of policies, but in terms of attitude, getting close to the place that House Republicans have been for a number of years, that they would almost rather burn things down than sustain things, that they don't feel there's really very much value in the system as it stands?
Listen, the point is that Donald Trump is trying to tear apart this country. He's trying to burn things down. So this is not a time to give in to him. This is the time to stand up to Donald Trump. And we have very few moments where we can actually do this. But the two biggest moments in the last year, the shutdown in March and the shutdown right here, in both cases, Senator Schumer has given in.
Any chance you might still get what you want here, by which I mean this is past the Senate, it goes to the House, Democrats seem united against it or nearly united against it, and maybe Republicans will not muster the votes to pass it?
Well, we don't know. It'll be a close vote in the House. The Democratic House caucus is quite united against this deal. And there are a lot of Democrats across the country who do not agree with these Senate Republicans who gave in and do not understand why Senator Schumer, who's supposed to lead Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, allowed them to do that.
Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you, Steve.
And we'll note that, as always, we invite multiple Republicans as well as Democrats on the program to discuss the shutdown. We'll keep reaching out to them.
The Americas was the only region in the world that eliminated endemic measles until Monday. Canada has now had local transmission of the highly infectious virus for 12 straight months. Experts worry the U.S. could soon follow. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports.
In the past year, the United States' neighbor to the north has seen more than 5,000 measles cases. And it's not just Canada. In the Americas overall, there's been a 30-fold increase in cases compared to last year, with the vast majority happening in Canada, Mexico, and the U.S.
It's incredibly disappointing and sad because measles is an entirely preventable disease.
Nina Schwalbe is with Georgetown University's Center for Global Health Policy and Politics. Measles can be life-threatening, but it can be avoided with two doses of a vaccine. The target is 95% of people immunized, but rates have dropped to 79% in the Americas.
It speaks to a lack of confidence in vaccines, which is hitting everywhere in the world.
She says this is driven by misinformation about vaccines, including from high-level politicians like President Trump and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The U.S. has seen big measles outbreaks since January of this year.
The U.S. is not far behind Canada. It's likely, certainly in the first quarter of next year, we'll lose our status.
But Daniel Salas of the Pan American Health Organization says he's optimistic the region can regain its measles-free status. A handful of years ago, he says, Venezuela and Brazil lost their status, but were able to get it back later.
In the case of Venezuela, for example, they had, like, for almost 3 years, a very, very aggressive, active surge of cases throughout all the country.
And Brazil, he says, zeroed in on communities with low vaccination rates and came up with targeted strategies.
Identifying influencers, positive influencers that can help, for example, in a moment that there is a fake news or something that might raise panic in the population.
Their success, he says, proves these strategies can be enough to stop measles in its tracks. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
We'll be right back.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Today, on this Veterans Day, my colleague Quill Lawrence has a new podcast out about an Iraq War veteran. It's a podcast years in the making. A decade ago, Quill first met Dave Carlson over a payphone from prison where he landed after troubles adjusting to life after war.
Do you have a call from
Dave,
an inmate at Waukesha County Jail?
Jail is the least therapeutic atmosphere you can probably ever imagine. Jail is, you come in one way and you leave three times worse.
When I got them both on the line recently, Dave Carlson was searching for a quiet place to talk.
I'm in the Milwaukee County Courthouse, just got out of court about 3 minutes ago. So I was looking for a spot to get a little bit of quiet.
And you're in court as the attorney?
Yes.
I start by asking Dave why he decided to trust Quill with his story in all its raw detail when he got that first phone call.
I think that one of my biggest strengths is also one of my biggest weaknesses. And that's been something I've done my entire life is I tend to trust people until proven otherwise. And so I think that it was just par for the course with me. He reached out. I thought it was impressive that a person wanted to talk to anybody in jail or incarcerated at that time about, you know, especially veteran issues.
Yeah.
And so I went for it.
Quill, why don't you tell me about what you were looking for? What were you trying to find out when you began talking to Dave?
Yeah, well, it had actually just been a different story I was doing that led me to talk to some veterans who were incarcerated. And that's when someone told me this fact, which I was kind of surprising, is that when you get incarcerated, you're a ward of the state. So in a way, it doesn't make sense for the VA to be taking care of you because a different part of the government is taking care of you. How well they take care of you is another question. And that's sort of what I was wanting to ask, like, what's it like to have combat PTSD and then be thrown into this environment where you can't let your guard down, where you can't really heal?
A lot of the story, Dave, is about your reentry back home from war. And part of it involves your service in Iraq, a place Quill and I, actually the place Quill and I met as journalists, and a sergeant who mentored you, Alwyn Cash. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, so I don't want to overplay Sergeant First Class Cash and my interaction. I think that it was special interaction for a private to be able to interact with a leader of that level. He had done the invasion. He was back again. He's a Bradley commander, a platoon sergeant. But in this case, he was absolutely willing to hear me. He was absolutely willing to put me on the missions that they were going on. He was a phenomenal leader, which obviously was shown to the world with that final act of heroism that he did on October 17th, 2005.
Yeah, and I should add, Alwyn Cash received the Medal of Honor posthumously for one of the most heroic acts I've ever heard of. I mean, he was pulling his soldiers out of a vehicle that had been hit in an ambush. He got seven guys out while everything was in flames. He died of his wounds later.
Dave, there was also this part of you that came back with survivor's guilt.
Absolutely. That has been one of the hardest takeaways from the 2004-2005 deployment was the fact that I went out with these guys. We went through like just insane situations, contact, firefights, RPG attacks, IED attacks, mortar attacks, all of these different things. But I'm segmented off in my own unit. These guys, not just Sergeant First Class Cash's platoon, but other platoons also treat me like family towards the end for volunteering to go out. But then after it's just done, we get taken off mission and there is these casualties. And it's like I never had any way of reconnecting or anything.
Quill, when you tell this story, you talk about the survivor's guilt and why it's such an important idea, especially to Iraq and Afghanistan vets, right?
Yeah. Sometimes people come home with this idea of, oh, I could have done more, or I'm not over there and my buddies are, and there's this feeling of guilt about it. But in this case, it was very specific. You can't go on this patrol. And within a couple of days, that patrol got ambushed. So it comes back more generally to a thing called moral injury. It's like a blow to the head and the heart. We all look back on our lives and think, if only this had been different. But I think this is kind of a torturous version of that.
Dave, you spent a lot of your life in violent situations. You fought a literal war. You came back and your instinct was still to react with violence. But you now talk about how your philosophy around violence changed. I just want to listen to a moment that really struck me when I was listening to the podcast.
There's a quote, and I'm going to butcher it possibly, but it's a proverb about, I would rather be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. And I think that it really speaks to, for me, it speaks to being able to defend yourself, to be able to do harm, but then having the discipline, having the empathy, having the compassion to not do it.
And so that's who Dave Carlson decides he's going to be.
I think the intimacy of this podcast is what makes it so impactful, because we're with Quill finding out your story, and your relationship gets closer over 10 years. You guys have been talking for 10 years. What are you going to do now that this podcast is over? Are you going to keep in touch?
Yeah, I hope so. I already texted him asking about going hiking on the Appalachian Trail. So that's probably the next thing, hopefully.
When you build this kind of trust, it's, I mean, impossible not to become friends, I think. And I'd love to do something that doesn't involve dragging up his worst memories to record. And I'd love to go on a hike. I'm just afraid he's going to make me go on like a 1,000-mile hike.
Yeah, into, I think like, you know, maybe go to lunch. Dave Carlson and his conversations with NPR's Quill Lawrence over the past decade is the subject of the podcast Carlson's War, which is now available in the Up First feed. You can also hear more of Dave Carlson's story on All Things Considered this afternoon. Quill, Dave, thank you both for sharing this story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Justinian Wong's new novel is about how the survival of a patriarchy rests on the shoulders of women. Wong says he drew inspiration from the women in his own life.
As I wrote this book, I fell back in love with my mom because I was like, she's brilliant.
I'm Elsa Chang. More on the new book, Lucky Seed, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phonology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date, November 11th. Today is Veterans Day, and everyone is invited to the Bemidji Senior Center's Veterans Day program. That's at 1 o'clock today. The first City Singers will perform, and Quilts of Valor will be presented.
Also happening today, Northern Lights Community School in Warba has a Veterans Day program at 1 o'clock. Vietnam veteran Dennis Jerome, a.k.a. DJ the DJ, will speak about his experiences. Also, the VFW Post 1720 in Grand Rapids has a program with doors opening at 11 this morning and then lunch and a program at noon. Our weather for today, partly to mostly sunny, highs 41 to 46 with blustery northwest wind. Our lows tonight near 29 and for tomorrow sunny with highs in the low 40s and breezy northwest wind. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s. Momentum Advocacy will hold a listening session on local news this Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. The goal is to pinpoint gaps in local coverage and discuss the role of local information. RSVPs are required. You can send an email to news@kaxe.org. And November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver of someone with this disease, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America has a helpline to provide support, answer questions, and connect you with resources. Find more info at alzfdn.org. Let us know what's happening in your community. You can send an email, psa@kaxe.org. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 11th, 1985, there's one last chipmunk dining on sunflower seeds outside of my window, and this fellow must have put off gathering food till the last minute because his cheeks are absolutely jammed full of sunflower seeds. If you looked at this guy from the tail end, the widest part of his body would easily be his cheeks. Now he will take those seeds and he'll bring them down in his den and he'll find a little spot down there where he will store them along with all the other seeds he's put up for the winter. And instead of hibernating, he's going to become torporous, which means his body functions will remain about the same they are for a waking chipmunk, but he will be sleeping for weeks at a time, only to wake up, walk across the hallway, dine a little bit on some of his stored seeds, and then disappear back into his sleeping room.
Stack futures are down 75 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, committed to making work work. Their HR, pay, and workforce management tools strive to help business leaders build trust and empower their people. More at ukg.com/work. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The FDA is removing warning labels from estrogen products used to treat menopause. The agency says the warnings about increased risks of heart attacks, strokes, blood clots, and breast cancer are outdated and misleading. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
For years, women have heard mostly about the risks of hormone therapy, and many doctors have been hesitant to prescribe it because of the FDA's black box warnings. But menopause experts say it's now clear that there are safe combinations and doses. Here's Dr. Joanne Pinkerton of the University of Virginia.
If you're under age 60 or within 10 years of menopause onset, when you start hormone therapy, you're going to see improvements in hot flushes, sweats, fewer sleep disruptions,
as well as protections against bone loss and fractures, and potential benefits for heart health, brain fog, and quality of life.
Hormone therapy, when it's dosed appropriately, can be given safely and have multiple benefits, but not all women can take it.
Dr. Pinkerton says some women have medical conditions that can make taking hormone therapy more risky.
So that's an estrogen-sensitive breast or uterine cancer, heart attack, stroke, blood clots, pulmonary embolisms. And, you know, it's really important that women have a discussion with an informed healthcare provider because you want to know what are the benefits and risks for you.
The black box warnings were based on data from studies including the Women's Health Initiative that pointed to cancer and blood clot risks. But the science has evolved a lot over the last 20 years. And importantly, there's been a shift in how estrogen is administered and new formulations making it lower risk. For instance, many women are now prescribed patches instead of pills.
Now we know that oral therapy does slightly increase the risk of blood clots and stroke. So if you have women who have risk factors or are older, you want to think about doing transdermal therapy.
Transdermal patches, gels, or rings can deliver estrogen directly through the skin, which may lower the risk of clots. And instead of giving women synthetic progestin, as was given in the Women's Health Initiative study and was linked to an increased breast cancer risk, doctors can now prescribe alternatives, such as micronized progesterone, which is identical to what's produced naturally in the body and has fewer side effects. Now, many menopause experts support the FDA's decision to remove warning labels from some estrogen products, but they don't all carry the same risks, explains Dr. Monica Christmas of the University of Chicago. She says many women benefit from estrogen creams for painful sex, bladder control, and reduced risk of urinary tract infections.
I think most would agree that with local low-dose vaginal estrogen therapy that the risks are negligible for most people. And so I do think for the local vaginal estrogen, it is reasonable to remove that black box warning. I don't think we need to scare people unnecessarily.
However, for higher dose systemic estrogen therapy, including estrogen pills, Christmas and other menopause experts are more equivocal about removing the warnings.
One of the nice things about the black box warning is that it does provide that pause. It allows patients to want to ask their healthcare provider what the black box warning means, what potential risks there may be, and what the safety is.
Women should not have to suffer with menopause symptoms, and Christmas says there are many options, including non-hormonal alternatives. She recommends talking to healthcare providers to help decide what's best. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The American dream, it's traditionally meant that if you work hard, you can achieve your goals. But now, many young people aren't sure that's possible anymore. All around the country, voters in their 20s and 30s are struggling to keep up with rising costs. But how is this changing their politics? NPR political reporter Elena Moore has been talking to young voters lately about their financial struggles. Elena, what have they told you?
Yeah, well, we recently did a call out asking young people to share how these concerns have shaped their lives and their politics. And we got over 1,100 responses from people across the political spectrum and in nearly every state. And many spoke about how constantly worrying about money has forced them to rethink what their future looks like. For 32-year-old Dylan Robertson in New York, that means he and his partner are delaying having kids because he's got so much student loan debt.
It just feels like I've got this like mountain of debt I've got to get out from under. And I just see a lot of struggle for us in the future. And it's really hard to imagine trying to start a family in the midst of all that.
Others, like 25-year-old Daisy Lupa, are dealing with career setbacks. She recently had to move back in with her parents in Michigan after not finding work following graduation.
It just makes me worried about how the economy as a whole is going to function. Am I going to be able to send my kids to college? Is it even a smart idea for my kids to go to college if advanced degrees are not a path to success anymore.
Oh, see, those are heavy, heavy concerns. How are these experiences shaping their view of politics?
Well, it's important to say Gen Z and millennial Americans are far from a monolith, but folks around the country told me they're feeling unseen by leaders right now, and it's left some politically directionless, you know, aligning with policy solutions that don't put them neatly in the Democratic camp or the Republican camp. That's what I heard from Paul Staley. He's 35 and lives in a small town outside of Birmingham, Alabama.
These issues are pushing people to the end of their political spectrum, where I think the answer lies more somewhere in the middle.
What did these voters tell you when you asked which politicians are speaking to them?
Well, in Staley's case, he's previously voted for President Trump, but says he's also drawn to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Zohran Mamdani of New York, both of whom are Democratic Socialists, by the way. So obviously, these leaders have very different politics, but they've kind of all diagnosed the problem in the eyes of a lot of voters. You know, they aren't afraid to criticize political norms, and they're proposing these bold solutions. Ruby Bell Booth studies young voters for the nonpartisan research organization Circle. Here's how she put it.
Young people, we've seen, are not really thinking about politics in terms of those two parties and are evaluating it more in terms of the issues that they really care about.
Which obviously gets us back to the economy. You know, it was the top priority for people under 30 last fall, and it pushed many to the right. But it's also a galvanizing issue on the left. You know, look at New York. Mamdani pitched himself as this anti-establishment candidate with ambitious ideas to address affordability concerns. And that obviously resonated. I mean, exit polls from last week found he got nearly 80% of the under 30 vote.
Now we're, what, less than one year away from the midterm elections?
What
will you be watching for?
Well, Gen Z and millennial voters already make up roughly half of the electorate. We've seen how these voters can help candidates really on both sides of the aisle when they're engaged. So I'm curious, I mean, can some of these candidates deliver? If they do, it could energize this increasingly important group. If they don't, folks may end up feeling even more let down.
That's NPR political reporter Elena Moore. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This is NPR News.
KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
It's 5:42. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday morning show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, your hosts Heidi Holton and John Latimer and National Native News. We'll hear student phonology reports at 6:45 and John Latimer's latest observations at 7:20. Today is Veterans Day. Thank you so much to those who have served our country. Our weather, partly to mostly sunny, highs 41 to 46, blustery northwest wind. Lows tonight near 29, and for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low 40s, breezy northwest wind. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now could be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it's a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps people-powered radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. Thank you for your support.
The Bemidji Area's 100-plus Women Who Care event is this Thursday at South Shore Hotel on Lake Bemidji. Social hour starts at 5. The event runs from 6 to 7. And the classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork this Thursday. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. Tune in tomorrow morning for a conversation with Jack Nackbar about that movie. More news is next on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. So I grew up in Indiana where there's corn. Don't mean to shock you. There's a lot of corn. And people used to talk about how you would harvest the corn when the corn is as high as an elephant's eye. There are no elephants really in Indiana. But anyway, that was the deal. Corn is tall. But now some farmers and agriculture companies are experimenting to grow shorter varieties of corn. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke explains why.
Farmer Chad Moore is a third-generation farmer who grows corn and soybeans on a farm in central Illinois. His seed dealer suggested he try a new product, short corn.
I had never heard of it before, and I've always been kind of looking to do things a little bit different, try things out on the farm year after year.
Now he's in his second year growing the agriculture company Bayer's short-stature corn, called Precion. The corn doesn't look too different from the road. It's only about 3 or 4 feet shorter than typical corn. But walking in a field, it's obvious.
This here is the shorter corn, the Precion corn. And if you just look down through the row, you can kind of see how thick and dense the leaves are.
The big change here is that short corn can be planted closer together without causing stress on the plant. Farmers can plant about 20% more short corn per acre.
So you've got a denser population, more ears, and it's just a lot more plant matter out here.
And that's the number one thing many farmers care about.
Whether the corn's short or tall, I want to make sure I got the yield out there, and that's the main goal of anything.
Making crops shorter to increase their yield has happened before. The Green Revolution in the middle of the 20th century focused first on wheat. Now, corn is drawing a lot of attention. Besides Bayer, several other seed companies are selling or developing shorter corn hybrids. Corteva Agrisciences will start selling its own variety of short corn in the next few years. Wendy Cernich, vice president of biotechnology, says farmers are really curious about it.
There's a lot of optimism, a lot of excitement, and we can't wait to get it in growers' hands so they can see what they think of it.
Cernich says besides increased yield, the shorter corn is less likely to get knocked over in strong windstorms. And there's another benefit. Shorter plants are much easier to treat with things like fertilizer or fungicides.
With tall corn, you kind of hit a window where you can't get into the canopy, you can't get into the field anymore.
When the corn is shorter, farmers can tend their crops without having to spray treatments from an airplane. These are all big improvements. But shorter corn is a small change in the grand history of this plant, says Iowa State University professor Pat Schnabel.
The humans that domesticated that crop changed it enormously over about a 5,000-year period or so.
Now, technology is making all kinds of other changes possible. Schnabel uses a computer program to dream up designer corn varieties.
What's the optimal number of leaves? What's the optimal width of the leaves? And then we can breed towards that.
Schnabel says it's too early to know if farmers will start widely growing short corn. But shorter stalks may be the next chapter in how humans alter the king crop. For NPR News, I'm Kate Grumke in Central Illinois.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to kaxe.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Klein Jamboree next Monday.
Movement in Congress to end the government shutdown doesn't help air travel on this Tuesday.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers comprehensive cybersecurity protection while automating cyber defense to stop threats so organizations can thrive. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Good morning to you. The Senate passed a bill last night to try to end the government shutdown and sent it on to the House for a vote. But in the meantime, more flights are being canceled. There are more than 1,200 U.S. cancellations so far, with dawn breaking in the east. According to the tracking site FlightAware, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Airlines have to reduce flights at the nation's 40 busiest airports by 6% today, part of an order from the FAA that ratchets up to 10% on Friday. The agency is trying to ease strain in the system caused by stressed-out air traffic controllers who are working without pay during the government shutdown. Nick Daniels is president of their union, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
The added stress leads to fatigue. The fatigue has led to the erosion of safety and the increased risk every day that this shutdown drags on.
Daniel says it's hard for the controllers to concentrate when they're worried about paying for childcare, gas, and groceries. He says some have taken second jobs to pay the bills.
Even though that there is a new light at the end of the tunnel, we'll call it that, every single day, an air traffic controller is still facing the issues that they had yesterday, and they're getting worse every single day.
And Daniel says controllers are very aware that the stopgap spending legislation the Senate passed only runs through January 30th, so they could be in the same position working without pay during a shutdown in just a few months if Congress can't agree on a long-term funding bill. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. The bond market is closed to honor Veterans Day. The stock market will open, and stock index futures are pointing generally down. Dow futures are flat. S&P futures are down 0.2%. NASDAQ futures down 0.4%. It's also a bank holiday today, so don't drive down and park only to find that out. Government offices are closed. Not that you'd necessarily notice, given the government shutdown.
Mark.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
At a time of stress, sometimes it helps to close your eyes and visualize a quiet forest or field of wildflowers. At a time of economic stress, don't close your eyes if you're driving, it may help to visualize the capital letter K. It's supposed to symbolize an economy that's going up for some and down for others. Now to an economist credited with getting the K-shaped economy into the national discourse, Peter Atwater researches behavioral economics and teaches at the College of William and Mary. Welcome.
Great to be here, David. Thank you.
I mean, it's radio, so we don't have a big letter K as a prop right in front of us, but if we place a K in our mind's eye, you hope the metaphor of K helps us see a kind of graph? Explain the metaphor.
Yeah, I think when most people think of the letter K and the K-shaped economy, they think of it in financial terms, but its genesis really had to do with a divergence in confidence that I first saw during COVID, where those who could work from home, principally white-collar workers, their confidence quickly recovered. Meanwhile, blue-collar workers, hospital workers, those whose jobs required that they be out in the real world, and they're the arm of the K, I could watch as their confidence continued to decline. And from that, because I believe economic activity follows how we feel, I anticipated that the economy would begin to bifurcate, that there would be two tracks, one for those at the top, one for those at the bottom.
Yeah, we just switched from COVID times to contemporary times. It does make sense to you, Peter, here in late 2025, that your K metaphor is back in force?
Yeah, it matters to me in two directions. One, we've seen extraordinary financial market performance. We've seen the value of homes remain robust and grow. For those with investable assets, their trajectory has continued upward. Meanwhile, we're seeing for those at the bottom of the economy, deterioration. They're later in their payments to their landlord, and they've experienced enormous food inflation, that the cost of living for those at the bottom has added additional weight. I think of those at the bottom as experiencing this heavy stack of vulnerability where they feel uncertain and powerless in multiple dimensions at once today.
Must drive you crazy when you see people spend too much time obsessing over the latest change in gross domestic product or where the stock market went over the last month. That's not necessarily capturing the reality of a portion of people in this country.
No, it's not. And it's an increasingly large portion. You know, if we think about, you know, 1 in 8 Americans is reliant on, you know, SNAP payments. I think we should all be concerned about this divide that is now so obvious and transparent and extreme that those at the bottom are intensely aware of the overabundance that exists above them. And I'm not sure those above really have any appreciation for what's happening below the surface.
Peter Atwater studies behavioral economics and teaches at the College of William and Mary. He's also author of the book, The Confidence Map. Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much, David.
And the Financial Times is reporting today that a pioneer of artificial intelligence, Turing Award winner Jan LeCun, is leaving Meta Facebook, where he was the chief AI scientist. The paper says he plans to found his own AI startup. LeCun is on the record as skeptical AI can learn to reason like a human. Earlier this year, Meta paid $14 billion to attract 28-year-old AI expert Alexander Wang to head up a superintelligence team there. Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition. And at 6:30, National Native News, 6:45, Student Phenology Reports. What have you been seeing in nature? You can text us 218-326-1234. Partly to mostly sunny today, highs 41 to 46, blustery northwest wind. Lows tonight in the upper 20s, and for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low 40s and breezy northwest wind. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive